Hey everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business for 2021. I am your host, Patrick Gray, and we got a bit to catch up on today. I do hope you all had a nice time over the holidays and that our friends and listeners out there are staying safe from the vid. Hopefully that will all be over soon, so just do hang in there. We're thinking of you. This week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences, and in this week's sponsor interview, we'll be talking to a Signal Sciences customer, Doug DePerry. He heads product security at the Gemini Crypto Exchange, and we'll be talking to him about what that's like because, those sorts of outfits tend to attract decent attackers. Adam Boileau can't make it today. He is on a mountain somewhere with no service, which, that sounds pretty good, to be honest. But yeah, we're going to recap some of the big events of the last 4 weeks without him today. And we've got a great lineup for you today. We'll be joined in just a moment by Joe Slowick and Dmitry Alperovich, and then Alex Stamos, Shannon Vavra, and Chris Wade are going to be popping along. They'll all be joining us to talk through the security news that matters. Let's kick things off now with a discussion about the big news story that broke, basically the moment we went on leave, which is often how these things happen. I am, of course, talking about Russia's campaign, their campaign against US targets, so the SolarWinds thing. It turns out Russian operators, we think from SVR, they hacked into a company named SolarWinds, poisoned an update, and then used that backdoor, the backdoor they planted, in that update to gain access to a whole bunch of targets. The attackers were brought undone in the end by their hubris when they attacked FireEye. That turned out to be a bit of a miscalculation. It turns out they popped up in all sorts of places. They got access to Microsoft source code. They tried to own CrowdStrike. Like, there's been a fair bit going on with this campaign. So joining me to talk through this now is Joe Slowick and Dmitry Alperovich. Joe works for Domain Tools these days as a threat researcher, and Dmitry is, of course, a co-founder of CrowdStrike, a company he left last year to spin up the Silverado Policy Accelerator. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Hey.
All right, so Joe, let's start with you. I mean, you're sitting on a mountain of domain data. I know that you've been spending time, really analyzing this campaign. Can you just start by walking us through the bare bones of what we know?
Sure. So based on work from a number of entities, I know Microsoft and FireEye have certainly released a lot of information, but also Reversing Labs did some good work that uncovered some of the early timeline, as well as some of the work we've done at Domain Tools. But it looks like, based on available information, this event started no later than October of 2019, when it appears that the adversary, UNC2452, or the Russians, however you want to refer to them, first gained access to the build environment for SolarWinds and was able to insert some sort of test code into releases. Not malicious, but just verifying that they could modify things. And from there, things slowly started to pick up with the migration of several existing domains. It's unclear for all of them if they were taken over by the adversary or if they were expired items that were re-registered by this adversary, but ultimately using older items to beat defensive checks for things like newness. And beginning in December of 2019, we start seeing changes in aspects for what would ultimately become the first stage command and control server for this attack, something called avsvmcloud.com. as well as starting to migrate over what would be the second stage C2 servers for the Sunburst activity. And then things went quiet for January and for most of February until at the end of February, it looks like at this stage, the attackers started to go live, because then the first stage command and control server was hosted. It began serving its own authoritative name server, which was instrumental to enable the encoded DNS C2 that allowed for the victim selection. And as Eric Helmvik at NetRESEC recently noted in a research report, also the identifying victim flag in the C2 DNS callout. And then it appears that the first attacks, or the first evidence of the malicious SolarWinds update, began to be introduced in March, with the first interactions beginning in April, at least based upon passive DNS data and other resources that are available to us. It appears that that attack then ramped up over the summer, especially in the June-July timeframe, before the primary C2 domain, AVSVM Cloud, was no longer hosted and essentially became inactive at the end of October, which perhaps that's when FireEye identified that they had a compromise and the adversaries began cleaning their tracks. So overall, we're talking about a attack sequence that lasted for at least a year, probably far longer, depending on how long it took to penetrate the SolarWinds environment and get access to the necessary resources in order to enable this attack. But very much indicative of a methodical, patient, and ultimately successful intrusion campaign.
Okay, so that is an excellent summary of the SolarWinds component of this campaign. But we also do know that from there, they sort of fanned out this campaign. Microsoft had a bit of a hard time as well. I believe CrowdStrike, they tried to pop CrowdStrike as part of this campaign. Whole bunch of other targets. Dimitri, why don't you walk us through some of the other elements here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Joe was really great at highlighting what happened with the SolarWinds intrusion vector, but we know that there were other intrusion vectors that the adversary used. At least one of them was the Microsoft reseller one, where we know at least one, possibly more, Microsoft resellers got compromised. And what happens with these resellers, as we're discovering, is that many of them have ongoing, continued administrative access to their customer cloud environments. So when you purchase Office 365 or Azure, in order to manage licenses, these resellers continue to have access. And if they're popped and those creds are stolen, then the adversary can go into customer instances, add themselves to things like Azure AD, activate the reading of Office 365 emails, and lots of other fun stuff. And that's exactly what they attempted to do with CrowdStrike, unsuccessful because CrowdStrike doesn't actually use Azure for anything but managing licenses. So there was no data in the cloud. But we know there are other victims as well.
So they successfully compromised a nothing burger, basically.
Exactly right. Yeah. And my guess is, and there are sort of rumors of this, is that there are other supply chain vectors that are not yet public. And it makes sense when you sort of sit back and look at this amazing operation, amazing espionage operation, probably by the SVR, whose goal was really to gain long-term access to high-value targets. You're not just going to say, oh, we're going to just compromise one company like SolarWinds, and that's going to be it. We're not going to put all our eggs in one basket. We're going to have multiple attack vectors that we're going to use to make sure that we can continue getting into those environments, even if we're discovered. And I think that's what we're probably dealing with here.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I got to say that, I'm pretty impressed, right? Like this campaign, it's just what we'd call, I think we called it in the newsletter, actually quite good hacking. It's funny that people are freaking out about this, right? Because there's a supply chain element when that's something we've seen before. I mean, CloudHopper is probably the most famous for that, right? When you're talking about this Azure stuff, I mean, pushing a poisoned update, that's edgy, right? But it seems like the operators in this instance took steps to minimize the risk to non-targets. So I'm not sure that there's much of a functional difference between doing that versus, you know, exploiting O-Day in enterprise software, which is something, you know, NSA, GCHQ, ASD probably do, like, you know, every day, every week, if not every day. Do you know what I mean? Like it's been interesting watching people react to this.
That's a good point. So if we look at this within the history of supply chain attacks, I know you mentioned CloudHopper, but let's go back a little bit further and talk about Dragonfly or Havix. That was an element which really was deeply concerning, as it did not really have the sort of victim checks and the various sort of logic gates that we're seeing with the SolarWinds infection vector and potentially other infection vectors, and was focused on critical infrastructure entities. And that, maybe it's just we've matured or gotten more concerned about these sorts of things, but we've been living with these sorts of attacks for over a decade at this point, with some really sensitive targets accessed or compromised as a result. Whereas, you know, to the credit of the adversaries here, which according to various U.S. government agencies is now confirmed as likely Russian, we'll see how likely changes over time, that, again, putting in a number of checks that certain national security lawyers might smile to themselves in looking at these and thinking about, oh, yes, this is a way to, you know, ensure that we're narrowly targeting only those entities of interest and avoiding something like a Stuxnet-like overspread where things start getting way out of control.
You mentioned a couple of campaigns there. One was Dragonfly. I didn't catch the name of the other one, or I can't remember it. But tell us about those campaigns.
So Dragonfly, also referred to as Havex or Crouching Yeti, because we don't agree on names in this industry, was a long-running campaign from at least 2010, possibly earlier, through 2013, that is assessed by various entities to be linked to Russian non-military intelligence, potentially the FSB. We're not completely sure about that. But it involved compromising the installers for several types of industrial-related software. So the attacker was able to install malicious payloads in manufacturing, in oil and gas, in electric utility environments through this supply chain vector. Now, we don't know of any deliberate disruptive event as a result of this, but certainly when you start looking at that selection of targets and the possibilities that emerge there, versus what we know about the SolarWinds vector and related entities, where we're talking about targeting government agencies, critical third-party software suppliers and security companies, that you can make an argument that someone has gotten more discreet over time, or potentially learned a lesson to be a bit more selective in terms of targeting and operations in order to risk the sort of hyperbolic response that we're seeing in terms of SolarWinds.
Well, okay. I'm glad you said that, right? Because people are reacting to this like it's not Petya shit thuggery, right? And it's not. It's not. No. It does look like they're careful. It's my concern that if we are, you know, by we, I mean, you know, the Five Eyes countries, if the reaction is this vitriolic, and we've seen comments from the incoming president, President Grandpa, as I'm choosing to call him on this show, we've seen comments from Biden saying, oh, we need to retaliate against this. You know, I worry that it'll demotivate Russian operators from being careful like this. Dmitry, you know, do you think the reaction to this has been a little bit overcooked?
No kidding. I mean, when you have senators saying that this is a declaration of virtual war, this is completely overblown. You're exactly right. This was a very patiently crafted, very careful operation. In fact, we should give them kudos for how careful it is, because the kill switch that they implemented in the command and control protocol is something that I haven't seen many people talk about. And that's the fact that virtually 99% of the victims, we now know, when they reached out to the C2, the initial C2 that Joe talked about, they received back a kill switch that actually permanently shuts down the malware, permanently shuts down their access to that environment. And in fact, I know for a fact that there have been victims that have downloaded the SolarWinds backdoor that received the kill switch that the Russians had previously targeted Russian intelligence services. So it was pretty clear to me that this was an operation designed to get into very, very high value targets, and they didn't care about anyone else. Now, I don't actually think that they were this careful just because they had lawyers telling them, please don't do this, don't do any Americans any harm. I think they were this careful because they wanted to maintain high degree of operational security and not get caught before they got what they needed.
I suspect it's a little bit in column A, a little bit in column B there, Dmitry. You know, I think it's there's an element of maybe not wanting this op to rock the boat so much.
Well, you go that route, and then we start raising the ugly head of cyber deterrence here, in which case we can start going down that interesting route.
Tell me what you mean by that.
So, you know, one line of reporting that I've seen with respect to this campaign is that, oh, this proves that Defend Forward failed because it took place. Well, that might be unfair and may actually prove that things like Defend Forward and persistent engagement, or the very sort of in-your-face defensive strategy that the United States has been pursuing over the past year or so, may have actually worked in that it provided strong incentives for the adversary in this case.
To be careful. Yeah. No, I'm
exactly.
I get you. I'm with you, right? But I do think there's been a little bit too much of the US patting itself on the back with the Defend Forward stuff, right? Like, there's an element of that. You know, you're never going to get total insight. And, you know, in this case, and this is, okay, so here's the crux of what I find interesting about this, which is, you know, a small team could pull this off, right? A small team could pull this off, get into the supply chain. I mean, the hacking they did when they were on target, like stealing key material and using it to forge SAML tokens and going up into people's 0365s, like it was just how it should be done. The C2 for the SolarWinds implant was protocol compliant. This is why no one saw it on the wire for 9 months. It's just good engineering. It's good hacking, right? Like this is actually good stuff. And there's no way you're going to have a defend forward strategy or human intelligence sources that are going to be able to tell you, you know, about what every single corner of Russia's intelligence community is doing. You know, it's just not realistic. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but it's, I feel like maybe some US policymakers have had some unrealistic expectations of their level of insight. What do you think of that, Dimitri?
I actually don't quite agree, because I do think this was a big intelligence failure. And you're absolutely right. We will never know about every single operation. But at the time when for the last 2 to 3 years, we have focused on Russia, by we, I mean the intelligence community, because of the need to protect the elections, and for the Russians to be able to run a campaign of this size, and by the way, something that we don't talk a lot about, but with the access that they had, particularly with the state and locals that are using SolarWinds and probably using Microsoft resellers for cloud, the Russians could have gotten in and interfered with election systems. No evidence that that was done. I want to make that very clear.
Well, one of the funniest things about all of this, right, is Trump World not linking this to their Dominion conspiracy theory about the election, right? And I called it. I called it in December when I wrote a tweet saying they won't do it. Because according to Trump World canon, Russia doesn't hack, right? And indeed, Trump's already come out and said it was, you know, it was probably China, right? So that's a funny element to all of this, right? Because if they weren't trying to be so internally consistent with their delusional stuff, like this could have been such a disaster, you know?
Yeah, and that's why I think it is an Intel failure, because the potential was there to interfere in elections. The potential was there to do a massive destructive attack. If they had released a NotPetya-style wiper through this access to thousands of organizations, including government agencies, it could have brought our government down to its knees.
Yeah,
it could have
brought down our economy. Of course, but that's what, you know, as Brett wrote in the newsletter yesterday, you know, it's ill-advised to formulate a policy response based on something Russia could have done. You know, we need to actually look at what they have done.
Absolutely. I view this as a case, good on them, shame on us for letting them. And I think we do need to look a lot. The response should be focused internally. How do we do better? How do we detect this sooner? How do we make changes in the Intel community? And I think there are a lot of changes to be made to make sure that we can pick up something like this. The fact that they use C2s hosted exclusively in the United States is not an accident, because the US Intel community has a hard time getting access to that information.
Yeah, because they can't operate domestically. That's an inspired little bit of operational practice that I haven't seen too many people focusing on. But yeah, they use C2s based in the United States because they know it's a legal nightmare for NSA to try to do anything with them.
Exactly right. So I think the response should be not what are we going to do about Russia. The response should be what are we going to do to reform our defenses, to give CISA more authority to hunt on federal networks, something that we've talked a lot about in the past. And how do we look at the failures of the Intel community here, both Humint and SIGINT, to see what we could do better? It doesn't mean that we'll catch everything going forward, but look, we said 9/11 was an Intel failure, and we can't be expected to detect every terrorist attack that happens. But when something big like this happens, I think it is fair to ask, what could we have done better?
Indeed. Now, look, final question for you both. It's interesting when you're trying to wrap your head around the scope of this, right? Because the potential scope is massive. We still don't know exactly where these operators are within our supply chain, right? We just don't know. But from what we've seen, it looks like it's been pretty tightly targeted, right? So I just wanted to get a sense from you guys how you expect this to play out. I think it's going to be months. There's going to be a steady, you know, drip over the next few months where we find more and more of this. I mean, one of the things that's happened, right, is through the unpicking of the SolarWinds stuff, incident responders were able to find other indicators, other techniques that they then, you know, released indicators for. And then, wow, these guys were actually in these other places that aren't SolarWinds customers. So we're still sort of unpicking a lot of it. But like, do you think the scope could unravel to the point where the rhetoric is justified? Or does this really just look, I mean, to me, it just looks like another APT campaign using some novel techniques. What's your sense for the ultimate scope of this? Let's start with you, Joe.
saying this is just another APT campaign, I think, is maybe a bit misguided, although there is some accuracy in that statement, because as we learned
today, just because
they
did it well doesn't make it different. You know what I mean? Like, you don't get to decide. You don't get to decide how Russia hacks you, right? Just because they hacked you in a way that you don't like doesn't make it particularly groundbreaking. That's just my view, though.
True, and I agree with that view. Where I would like to set this apart a little bit isn't so much in terms of intentionality, but rather in terms of impact and recovery, because given the nature of at least two of the vectors that we talked, the SolarWinds one in a good amount of detail, the Microsoft reseller one in less detail, and potentially other vectors that we don't yet even know about, and then follow-on activity that really relied upon subverting trust within victim networks, relying upon things like forging tokens and similar techniques, is that this is going to be a very hard sort of intrusion for many organizations to recover from, or even to identify if they were even victims in the first place. Because one of the things that I don't think has gotten enough attention, if you look at the various vendor reporting from FireEye, Vilexity, Microsoft, and Symantec recently with their own perspective, is that it almost looks like when you start getting into the second and third stages of these attacks, that we're seeing per victim established infrastructure, so that an indicator-based approach, did you see traffic to this network address or to this domain, goes out the window. And people are going to be chasing shadows for the next several months, let alone weeks, trying to figure out if this was a thing for them or not, and may never really be able to satisfactorily answer that question.
But that's how it should be done. I mean, you know, I hate to be giving $5 and a sun hat good to Russian operators, but yeah, it's good. Dmitry, what are your thoughts on that?
I think I said this a few weeks ago. We can't have a standard that says espionage is okay to do for nation states. Just don't be too successful at it or don't be too stealthy. So I'm totally with you, Patrick. This is espionage. Unless something changes where they release.
This isn't just espionage, Dmitry. This is champagne espionage.
Very, very true. But, you know, if we see an active measures component to this where stolen email suddenly end up on, you know, leaked sites or what have you, then I would have a very different approach to this. But there's no evidence that that is indeed the case right now. But I do think in terms of scope, this is going to be way, way bigger. You know, I said this on Twitter a couple of days ago. What do FireEye, SolarWinds, Microsoft, and CrowdStrike have in common, and some others as well? They're all perfect supply chain vectors. And does anyone really believe that the adversaries limited themselves to just those four? I don't. I think there are going to be many more that we're going to uncover in the coming days and weeks.
All right. Well, look, thank you both for your perspective. Really appreciate you both coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from Shannon Vavra, the reporter at CyberScoop. A big announcement came out from the US government today talking about this campaign. It looks like so far they've only been able to identify up to 10 US government networks that have been affected in this campaign. So it looks like the scope for now is pretty limited. But Shannon has been diving into the statement, and here's what she told me.
The new statement from the National Security Council, the FBI, NSA, ODNI, and CISA on the SolarWinds breach gives us insight into what the U.S. government's investigation is uncovering. We learn a couple of key things. First, we learn that the U.S. government suspects this is likely Russian actors, as has been indicated in reporting in multiple news outlets in recent weeks. But it's important because that's the closest we've gotten to even skirting the line on attribution from the U.S. government. It's the first time the U.S. government has publicly pointed the finger at Russia in this case. It also flies in the face of what President Trump tweeted earlier, suggesting that maybe China was behind the SolarWinds breach, maybe it wasn't Russia. This is a tentative but clear rejection of that assertion. We also learn a couple of other things, that the coordination group at the National Security Council that was stood up to coordinate multiple agencies' efforts to respond to SolarWinds, we learned this coordination group suspects that for now, this effort looks like it was an intelligence gathering effort. So sort of big picture and zooming out here, the statement comes after weeks of uncertainty around the breach, how much damage has really been done. SolarWinds works with 400 plus Fortune 500 companies, all five branches of the military, 300,000 customers overall, at least as it reported on its website before it took that information down. And lawmakers have been sending flurries of letters to agencies and departments in the U.S. asking for details and more transparency about what the extent of the damage really is. The National Security Council statement, and from all of these departments and agencies, suggests that the National Security Council is working on an attempt at reassurance in a moment of chaos. In the statement, it acknowledges 18,000 public and private sector entities could have been affected, but they suspect it's far less. On the other hand, you know, it's still very early on into the investigation, and the statement gives us a sense that the U.S. government is still investigating and looking into what really happened here and the extent of the damage. They say as much in the statement. You know, when we look forward to what we can expect in the months ahead, we've already seen a slow trickle of information coming out from at least the private sector about what is compromised and how deeply things are compromised. There's likely far more that we still don't know and that's still being investigated. So while the statement from the National Security Council appears reassuring, it's still early stages and it may only be the tip of the iceberg.
So that's where we're up to. Now, I'm going to bring on our next guest. Alex Stamos is at Stanford University these days, but he previously served as the chief security officer for both Facebook and Yahoo, and he is a regular guest and sometime co-host on this program. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
So, look, we're going to move on to some of the other news of the week, but I just wanted to get your high-level thoughts on this whole thing while you're here, because, you know, various APT crews have been targeting third parties in the supply chain for quite a long time now. You know, think of like the CCleaner attack, the Avast thing, the CloudHopper, you know, the companies affected in the CloudHopper campaigns. It's also thought that Belgicom and Realtek were targeted possibly by Five Eyes Nations. So, you know, my question is this. Do you think it's unreasonable to expect adversaries to leave the supply chain alone if they are taking steps to minimize risks to non-targets? Because, you know, in this case, the operators did actually, they even disabled their own access to most of the SolarWinds machines that they could have accessed. So, like, I agree that access hoarding would be a concern, but this wasn't that. So, yeah, the question is it unrealistic to expect adversaries to not do this sort of thing? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is I do think it's unrealistic based upon the norms that we as Americans have set and our Five Eyes colleagues in the past. This whole discussion has unleashed a how many angels can dance on the head of the pin conversation among kind of the cyber Twitterati of people that sit on that policy and tech barrier, where people with very different backgrounds come to very different conclusions. And it's been fascinating to watch, because it also seems like a lot of the conversation has not been informed by all of those supply chain attacks you just mentioned, some of which were done by American adversaries, some of which were done by the United States and by our allies. And as you pointed out, like, this is not an uncommon way for one group to get very high leverage, that you spend a lot of investment in the supply chain, you do a really good, subtle job, and then that gives you a lot of leverage for access. And the interesting question then becomes, what do you use that access for?
Yeah, and I think that's the important part. Although, I mean, it must be said, we haven't really seen adversaries pushing poisoned updates much. I mean, it has happened in the past, but, you know, I mean, think of like NotPetya. That's probably why it's freaking everyone out, is because they're thinking of what can be done with that type of access. So this is maybe something that a cautious America, and America is actually kind of cautious when it comes to things like this, maybe something they wouldn't do, but I don't think it's like so far over the line. You know, everybody's freaking out about it, but I don't see it.
Yeah, I mean, one, it's hard to have the conversation now because we don't really, you know, tomorrow it could be discovered that as part of this campaign, something destructive happened, and that's going to change the context of the conversation completely, right? So yeah, it is difficult while we're still in the, what I think is still the early stages of the global investigation that's happening here, to be able to say whether the access was appropriate or not. But assuming that this access was created only for espionage purposes, I think it is difficult to argue that is out of the lines that have been created, that have been drawn in the past.
Yeah.
That being said, I think there's a legitimate discussion of, was it a mistake to draw the lines that broad? And I don't think we're going to have that honest conversation, because it means addressing some.
It means uncomfortable looks in the mirrors is what it means, right? Like, and it's,
yes.
I could just imagine, right. You know, we've seen like various politicians in the States, you know, tweeting out like some pretty, you know, full on stuff saying, you know, this calls for a strong retaliation and whatever. I can just imagine someone from Fort Meade, like Nakasone or someone, like ringing up those politicians and saying essentially, shut up.
Right. Well, right. And it's, and I think like you have politicians saying this is an act of war. Now the truth is if a war starts, right, either like a kind of an online only, but a real shooting war starts, this is exactly the kind of access you do not want your adversaries to have. So there's a legitimate concern there, right, of the capability. But the creating the access himself, not really an act of war. And it's a little bit, to do a little bit of a Cold War analogy, it's a little bit like missile placement, right, of the you know, early 60s, the U.S. with missiles in Turkey.
I mean, that's where I was going with the whole access hoarding stuff. That's different.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the fact that they actually took steps to turn off their access, like they actually locked themselves out of most of the targets. I mean, I think that's a signal. Well, maybe they were just being careful. Maybe it was OPSEC. But look, you know, we've done this topic to death already. So let's move on because we've got other news to get through. One big story that broke just recently is the bulk, the juicy part of Apple's copyright case against Corellium. They lost, which I got to be honest, I'm quite surprised by, to see Apple, you know, biggest company in the world, lose its copyright claim against a very, very small company.
Right. And so for full disclosure, I'm not completely neutral in this. I was a pro bono expert witness on behalf of Corellium. So I did not get paid. But
well, I read your amicus brief in the case. Yeah. And when you read the judgment, it seems pretty clear that the judge was swayed by specifically what you wrote.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm not going to take, you know, there's some good lawyering going on here. A lot of people fighting this. But I did believe pretty strongly that the argument Apple was making in this case would create a precedent where effectively any shipped software vendor could prevent the kind of security research that we have expected of ship software for a very long period of time. Like we already have all kinds of problems with cloud products and the DMCA and security issues with bug bounties and the like. But you know, this was almost like a Cisco, you know, people getting arrested at DEF CON mid-2000s flashback, the argument Apple was making here. And so the fact that they lost, and not just lost, but they lost pretty badly, and in a very early in the process, I think is very positive and is a good positive move for security researchers, not just Corellium and Apple, but really for a precedent that would have been very dangerous elsewhere.
Well, I mean, they're virtually guaranteed to appeal the ruling, right? Like, we know that's going to happen.
Yep.
And meanwhile, the DMCA component of the suit, the judge decided to let that one go to trial. And that's, you know, that's the weird one that everyone's worried is going to, like, ban jailbreaking and whatnot. It seems like a pretty weird DMCA claim to me, but I'm not a lawyer. And clearly the judge thought there might have been something in it because he's allowed it to go forward. What can you tell us about that component of the case?
Yeah, so I mean, that is another interesting issue, and a lot of it relies upon arguments of fair use and what kind of reverse engineering is allowed under DMCA. You know, the DMCA has been disliked by a number of legal observers of the cyber world for a while, and part of it is that it uses terms and words that don't really apply to how people do this kind of work now. And so a lot of that is going to require the judge to apply what is actually a pretty thin set of precedents to this kind of situation. But that also has risk. And like you said, that's going forward. So this argument is not over, but the copyright suit, I think, was the one that everybody was more worried about. And I think, you know, the fact that that is behind is good. It will be appealed, but you know, that appeal will rely upon the findings of fact that this judge created, which I think is positive for Corellium and security researchers.
Yeah. I actually have a statement here from Chris Wade of Corellium, one of the founders of the company, and here's what he had to say.
Look, I think one of the best things about this ruling is it's not just favorable to Corellium. It's also a major victory for security research. Corellium's mission has always been to advance the field of security research, and that's what we'll continue to fight for. I think at this point, we've really proven we're committed to promoting and defending the work the security research community does, and I personally am hopeful that Apple will take this opportunity to work with us rather than against us and push security research forward.
So there we go. A bit of a olive branch there from Chris Wade by the sound of things.
Well, you know, and that's one of like the kind of meta issue that's been happening here is that there's been this weird back and forth between Apple and Corellium where they talked about Apple buying Corellium and talked about partnership and then ended up with lawsuits. And so I do find the background here to still be really interesting. It was nice to hear that olive branch from Chris. I'm sure he's very sincere in his love of Apple and Apple products.
Hey, he is actually a bit of an Apple fanboy. That's the thing about Chris, right? Like he does legit love Apple products. But anyway, so it's a strange world, isn't it, Alex? It's a strange world. Julian Assange, his fans are cheering because a British judge denied his extradition to the United States to face charges, including espionage. I would be holding off on the celebrations if I were them, because the judge did actually find that, you know, Assange was not acting as a journalist when he was doing things like, you know, offering to crack hashes for Chelsea Manning. So basically the judge said if it were not for Julian's poor health, she would have agreed to the extradition order, but the idea that he could wind up in Supermax like ADX Florence or something, he would probably kill himself at this point, given his fragile state. So this makes me wonder, and I'm not even sure if this is possible. We haven't been able to pin it down yet. We're going to have to speak to some lawyers. It does make me wonder if DOJ can take Supermax off the table, right? Like in the same way that Australia insists on the death penalty being taken off the table before we will extradite someone to another jurisdiction. I wonder if they, you know, DOJ could actually give an undertaking that he would not be sent to a facility like that, where he clearly doesn't belong. I mean, he's not Hannibal Lecter, for God's sakes.
Right.
It was an interesting result, right?
It is. And I think you're right that like the people celebrating this are celebrating a little early. There's some things in this ruling I absolutely agree with. I mean, the truth is the U.S. penal system is horrible in many ways, and we put way too many people in these supermax prisons. We put way too many people in solitary confinement as a society. It is completely appropriate for other countries to judge that during their extradition requests. Like you said, the judge found that he can stand trial for this crime, which is the big fight that they're having. And so I think you're right. What you probably will see is a DOJ. This happens all the time where the United States says we will not seek the death penalty, we'll not do this or that. I don't think there's any good way for another country to enforce that, but the DOJ's word is very important in this case, and especially with the UK, with whom the US does lots of extradition, I expect that the DOJ would follow any deal. And, you know, there's no really good reason for him to be in a concrete box 23 hours a day. Like you said, if Assange was at Club Fed in Connecticut while his trial was going on, that's probably does not make, as an American citizen, I don't feel any less safe.
Yeah, exactly. It just seemed like, I mean, it was interesting that his lawyers were able to argue that he'd probably wind up in Supermax, because at the time I thought, gee, that seems a bit over the top. But it turns out that the judge was satisfied that that was within the realm of possibility. So I think our joke in the newsletter was they need to promise to send him to a nice prison with good psychiatrists and a ping pong table, you know?
Right. And there is a pretty wide variety of different penal systems, even just in the United States federal system.
Yeah. Anyone for tennis?
Martha Stewart. Right. Well, not quite that good. But yes, where Martha Stewart spent her time or the celebrities that bought access to USC is very different than ADX Florence.
Now, Facebook's lawsuit against NSO, this of course relates to the exploitation of WhatsApp. That lawsuit is chugging away. Microsoft, Google, and Cisco and some others have filed an amicus brief in support of that lawsuit. I mean, that's the entire tech industry basically lining up behind Facebook in this case. Do you think that's significant?
I do, and I was actually a little bit surprised to see this. There's a lot of interesting issues here where there are some strange bedfellows on this issue, because this is a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act issue. Computer Fraud and Abuse Act has been misused in the past to stop legitimate security research or to over-prosecute crimes. And so you have a lot of people who dislike NSO and their operations still feeling queasy about this lawsuit. Because they don't like the expansion of CFAA, which doesn't only affect the ability for Facebook to sue, but the capability of U.S. attorneys to use it. That being said, for these companies to come down on Facebook's side is a little bit surprising, because they, maybe not so surprising with Microsoft. Microsoft has a nice long history here. But Cisco and some of the other kind of IT companies, the fact that they're basically saying, you know, just because you're building products to exploit our systems on behalf of governments does not give you an out, I think was pretty powerful. That being said, like the actual, what happens with the lawsuit here is going to be interesting because it really relies upon Facebook making an argument about NSO Group talking directly to Facebook servers and not just the creation of the exploit, which is going to mean bringing out a bunch of evidence that we have yet to see.
Well, I want to see that evidence because if their argument is that, you know, they've got standing because the message was carried over WhatsApp services, then that seems a bit odd, to be honest, that it was just routed through their infrastructure.
Right. And so the argument they've made in previous filings is that NSO Group built special infrastructure that spoke directly, that, you know, so they did not send the exploit via the WhatsApp client. You know, so this isn't like you moved a binary onto a client and then sent it with the right code, that they interacted and kind of jumped into the middle of the conversation using custom equipment that they had set up that NSO Group controlled, and that their customer and the government pushed the button, but that NSO was interacting with Facebook servers in a way that violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is going to get, like, this is going to be an argument down to the binary compatibility of the client that NSO Group built to be compatible with, and did they violate any controls in place and such. It's going to get really,
well,
really
deep. Then you get into that whole argument about authorization and whatnot. And, you know, in this case, we would want the CFAA to be really restrictive, whereas in most cases, we actually don't. So I feel like there's some dragons in this one.
Yeah, it is somewhat risky. It also goes to, like, just another issue, which is effectively, there's no good legal recourse for somebody who's a victim of NSO Group. You have to rely upon Facebook doing this for you. And I think I think a better outcome here would be if CFAA was more limited and Facebook didn't have this capability, but that then Facebook could fund the victims to sue NSO in U.S. court for the damages that were done to them by this malware. And I think that would be the kind of argument that a lot more people could get behind.
Now, another thing that dropped when we went on break was a huge report from Citizen Lab looking at, you know, the sort of stuff Citizen Lab looks at. In this case, they found a whole bunch of, like, zero-click iOS, you know, ODAI that was targeting Al Jazeera journalists.
Yep. So Citizen Lab, again, doing fantastic work. They really kind of own this space find very impressive things. In this case, these zero-click bugs were a big deal. But not just another bug. I think one of the other great things here is that these exploits did not work in iOS 14. And because of the story, we found out that there's actually hardening of the messenger architecture in iOS. It looks like specifically due to Citizen Lab's work in the past. So that's like real great impact on getting Apple to take process isolation seriously,
I'd be careful about that, right? Because a lot of people say, oh, look, it's because of Citizen Lab's work, or, oh, look, it's because of Google Project Zero's work. I mean, you know, messaging security is something that a lot of the people who work at Apple spend a lot of time thinking about. So I'd be a little bit careful about ascribing those as the motivators. You know what I mean? Like, it might be what it looks like from the outside, but I have seen some grumbling. Let's put it that way.
What I would say is it should not have taken until iOS 14 for some of this basic isolation work that Adobe did in Acrobat years ago to be done in iOS. It is a little bit embarrassing for Apple that, so maybe it wasn't due to any one specific piece of research, but the fact that it got this far is unfortunate.
Now, speaking of Adobe, we've got some funny news here. It turns out they actually inserted like a time bomb into the most recent Flash update. So basically, yeah, if you were running up-to-date Flash, it's going to self-destruct essentially on January 12, 2021. It won't run anything new. I actually did have a chat to Brad Arkin. He's not there anymore. He's at Cisco, but it was sometime last year that it just came up in conversation. He's like, oh no, we've planned the end of life of this thing very carefully. Like, they're trying to make it dead. It's actually borderline. Yes. It's kind of funny the way they've done it, which is to sneak a time bomb into it and not tell anyone until it's been installed, right?
Right. In a just world, you know, hopefully 60, 70 years from now, Brad Arkin's obituary would be on the front page of the New York Times. It would talk about how he was the man who finally killed Flash.
Yes.
Like, this was a something that, you know, he has been very subtle about, but has worked very hard to get Adobe to understand the risk that Flash was posing to themselves and to the entire ecosystem, and pushing through this process to the point at where we're at now.
There's so many stories that I've picked up from, you know, various people relating to Flash within Adobe, where like the security team would be trying to kill it, and then, you know, some product team elsewhere, like in some completely part of a different part of Adobe, sort of made a project that depends on it. So they had to just sort of kick the can down the road. Like, it was just this tug of war, but the security team really did work hard to get rid of it. And they've won. They've won.
I mean, my personal run in here was like when I just started at Facebook.
I remember this.
Yeah, we were dealing with a situation where Flash was being used to drop malware on the machines of protesters in Hong Kong. And so, you know, our threat intel team is trying to actively find MSS agents who are inserting themselves into Facebook groups and Messenger groups and then dropping Flash O'Day. And then it turns out that that bug had been known to Adobe and had not been patched, because at the time, Adobe had like one half of an engineering FTE on sustained engineering for Flash. And so when I found that out, I tweeted, "It's time for Adobe to kill Flash." And that pissed off the CEO of Adobe so much that he called Sheryl Sandberg to try to get me in trouble.
Well, and I believe it may have actually worked, because you seem to tone it down a little bit after that.
Well, yes, I don't think Sheryl would agree on me toning it down appropriately. But yeah, I tried to be a little bit more careful. But it is nice, you know, 5 years later to see that Adobe has finally done the right thing.
It's dead. It's dead. It's dead. In Kazakhstan, this is something that we predicted last year. You know, they've tried again introducing their like person in the middle HTTPS cert that like everybody has to use so the government can see everyone's communications or you can't get internet access. As predicted, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Mozilla have all banned that particular certificate in updates. So yeah, I mean, it's just not going to be something that countries can do and expect to use, you know, mainstream browsers. I mean, if they're going to want to do this, they're going to have to fork the browsers and, you know, maybe even control the OSs as well, because this is going to be treated, you know, forcing people to use certs like this, it's going to be treated as a hostile act by most of the platform makers, right?
Yeah. I mean, Kazakhstan's crime here is that they're just too obvious about it, to be honest, right? There are a bunch of certificates that are trusted by mainline browsers and operating systems that have very sketchy relationships with governments that have a history of doing this kind of stuff. But they're very subtle relationships, and there's not good examples of those certs being used for widespread interception.
Well, that's the problem, is all the browser makers have actually implemented the telemetry, which will tell them when people are doing this, which is why they can't really do it at scale.
Right. And so, the transparency matters that the browsers put in mean that it would be difficult to get away with doing anything but a extremely targeted attack. But the fact here that Kazakhstan just effectively announced to the world, "We're going to do this so we can man in the middle everybody's connection all the time," made that it was a pretty easy call, I think, by the browser companies. But I do think we still have some issues in the CA world that, you know, the Google team has specifically been working on, but that have not been totally fixed yet.
Such as?
Well, there's still that CNIC cert, right? Like there's still a bunch of certificates that are trusted by some of the major browsers and operating systems that are have government relationships that aren't that trustworthy. So like you said, now that we have telemetry from some of these different matters, you're not going to have those used in a very widespread, but every once in a while,
you don't want them using them selectively either, really, do you?
Right. Like when you see one of these like China Telecom BGP hijacks for 15 minutes, it does make you wonder exactly what that's being used for, right? And I am a little worried sometimes about some of the CAs that are out there.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And we're going to do a skateboarding dog this week, which is the Zodiac Killer Cipher got cracked by an international team, including an Australian mathematician. And yeah, they deciphered his last message. And it turns out he doesn't, you know, when you read this message, he doesn't strike me as the most stable gentleman.
Right. Yes. Everybody thought it would be, Tennyson when you did it, but it turns out to be the crazy ramblings of a psycho serial killer. The Zodiac Killer is a pretty big deal around here. I'm a native Northern Californian. This happened well before I was born, right? But like this, the mystery of who this man is has been something that people revisit here every once in a while. There's actually a pretty good film about the hunt for the Zodiac Killer and the fact that there was a guy that was pretty well suspected that they could never prove was behind it. But in this case, you know, finally his last message was decoded and is just sounds like a normal crazy person kind of teasing the cops and other people who
and talking about how he has slaves waiting for him in paradise because he killed all of the people and now there is slaves. And it's like, yeah, it's proper serial killer stuff, right?
Yeah, it's just straight up serial. Like if you saw it on a TV show, you would think it was too arch, right?
Yeah,
like it's,
yeah,
it's just totally. A little, and it's kind of, it's just kind of interesting to me that somebody that was this nuts and didn't apparently have any kind of like real cryptographic background came up with a code that took so long. I mean, there is an arresting kind of, with a pretty simple cipher. So anyway, it's a cool little moment. I think there's a couple more of these mysteries that are still out there of ciphers people have left behind, but this is one of the big ones.
Yeah. So links in the show notes, everyone. But that is actually it for the news. We're not going to try to cover exhaustively everything that we missed over the last few weeks while I was on break, because that would result in a 3.5-hour podcast. But we've covered the main stuff. Alex Damos, thank you so much for joining us while Adam is off on a mountainside surrounded by kindly sheep. I do appreciate it. And we'll chat to you again soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, and on behalf of the world, Patrick, I'd like to ask you not to go on vacation again, because this is what happens every single
time. There's a new baby coming. There's going to be a bit of that this year. I'm just giving you adequate warning.
Oh, no. Parental leave. That means World War III.
That was Alex Damos there with a chat about quite a few things, actually. And he did actually correct me after the recording. He wrote an expert witness statement for Corellium, not an amicus brief. So that was my mistake. Sorry about that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Doug DePerry, the head of product security at the Gemini Cryptocurrency Exchange. This week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences, and Gemini is a customer. And I really like it that Signal Sciences is getting their customers to do these sponsor slots. They started doing that last year, and I love that they made that decision. As much as I trash talk cryptocurrencies, there is no doubt that operating an exchange is a security challenge that's a little bit more extreme than the usual environment. You're up against highly motivated attackers, and there's real money, virtual money, on the table, right, for attackers who can successfully compromise these environments. So Doug joined me for this interview, and I started off by asking him if working in a security role at a cryptocurrency exchange is as crazy as you would expect, and here's what he had to say.
You know, you always have to be kind of on, right? And so it's not quite as hectic as I thought it might be, because, I thought the same thing, right? When I first thought of going to like a cryptocurrency startup or going to like a company in this general area, I thought for sure, like, you know what, I could probably do a month or two there and then I would just burn out and have to go and do something else, but it'd be a really cool experience. It's not necessarily like that day in and day out, at least in my role, but there is quite a lot of things being thrown at us on a daily basis. And it's just a lot of interesting problems, a lot of interesting constraints as well within that realm.
So instead of it being like the regular job times 10, it's more like the regular job plus 20%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's a good way of putting it.
So it's a little bit more relaxing than people might assume. I'm guessing though, a lot of the core security work is going to be about limiting the types of losses that you could experience if you suffered a compromise, right? Like that would be, a lot of that engineering is designing for failure, right?
Yeah. And it's, honestly, it's still I kind of approach things by trying or looking at solving the basic problems, right? Like something almost silly like patch management, right? Like technically speaking, that's not a very difficult problem to solve, but practically it is, right? Like show me someone who's doing that perfectly,
Brett Winifred, who writes our newsletter, I'm just remembering a conversation I had with him many years ago when he'd left journalism to go work for actually Australia's Commonwealth Bank, right, in a security role, sort of like an outreachy sort of role. And he said to me, we bumped into each other at a conference, and he said to me, I had no idea how much effort, just enterprise-wide effort goes just into patching. Right? Like it's one of those things where you think as an outsider, you just think, oh, patching, you run the patch, problem solved. It ain't like that.
No, not even close. And so like with crypto, I think the ability to iterate is, you know, like iterate in production, for instance, is definitely different too, right? Because it's, you know, you make one mistake and it's not necessarily where, you know, your customers can't access their thing for a little bit. It's, you know, money could go out the window, right?
Yeah.
And like irretrievably. So it's different even than traditional finance where, you know, if, depending on the amount of money that that gets stolen or repurposed, you know, like you can trace your way back and, you know, obtain some portion of that.
Yeah.
Crypto, it's gone. It's gone. Right.
It is. Your internet money is gone.
The stakes are higher.
The stakes are definitely higher, right? And the other thing is, too, you've got attackers that are actually incentivized enough to do original research, right? Like, they're not just going to try a few things. I mean, they're going to do the proper thing, right? Like, they're going to footprint your organization. They're going to enumerate your stack. They're going to try to do everything they can to find a way in. Even if that means, man, if there's like, if they can find some ODA in some component you're using, they're going to do that, right? So you have to design accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, it's about reducing blast radius, right? Like there's some things you can control and some things you can't. And then the ones that you can't, you try to build a wall around them so that if there is a failure there, it's the smallest failure or the easiest failure to handle as possible.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, on the show, like, you know, every week when I'm doing news prep, there are stories of crypto exchanges getting wiped out, right? Like huge amounts of money. But to me, that doesn't strike me as a security issue. That's like a process problem where they shouldn't have had that much available hot in the first place. Like how much of the challenge for you is about managing that, you know, those balances between hot and cold and like how does that factor into your job?
Not as much, to be honest. That's not really what I'm focused on at the moment. Kind of in the process of building up the team and figuring out, you know, exactly where we may be a little thin and like building things up there or like reducing the manual burden. We do a lot of manual code review right now. You know, like things are, again, like a traditional finance sort of company where risk is, you know, where folks are. I mean, you could say risk averse or at least very risk is very calculated in a traditional finance model or traditional finance company. And so things move very slowly because you want to be very sure, especially in a regulated industry as well. You want to be very sure that the proper people have checked the right boxes and the code does what you want it to do and has been QA'd properly and all that sort of thing too. But, you know, to keep pace in a world that moves as fast as the crypto industry, you have to be able to move faster as well. And so my team is like, looking towards, you know, ways to enable, empower developers to do their job securely and quickly.
Doug, can you tell us about some cool attacks that you've seen, right? Because I imagine you would have seen some cool stuff, right? Like where you would have been, you know, I love asking people who are in defensive roles, like what's an attacker, you know, an attack that you saw and defeated that you thought, geez, like either that was a close call or you were like, geez, that was pretty cool technique. You know, can you tell us about some stuff you've come up against from attackers?
Yeah. So I haven't been with the company too long, so I haven't seen a ton of stuff, a ton of like successful things. You know, certainly some attempts. We do get a lot of account takeover types of attacks, credential stuffing, that sort of thing, or attempts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's bread and butter for people in there.
Yeah.
You know, that's just bread and butter stuff. That's not the cool stuff, though.
honestly, as far as the cool stuff, nothing that I've been read into as of yet, you know, but again, like I'm kind of focused at the application layer and working with product teams and devs and stuff like that. So, if you want, next time we see each other, maybe we'll have some good stories after I talk get to know our threat detection and response team a little bit better.
Excellent. So what is your, like as an AppSec person, right, who's responsible for running these security programs, like what products do you use? I mean, obviously you use Signal Sciences, that's why you're here, but I'm guessing you've got some sort of like white source or SNCC equivalent, right? You know, you've got some sort of static analysis stuff. Like what does your tech stack look like over there?
Sure. So, you know, the whole like build versus buy thing is, I think, a very interesting way of approaching like certain types of problems. And I've been looking at it now for a few years as more of like a build and buy sort of thing rather than, you know, making that either or that binary decision. And so it's like, you know, I'm kind of focused on what will get me to my desired state as efficiently as possible. Right. So, you know, is it, you know, could I write some script or write some code to go and troll the CVE database looking for the latest vulnerabilities in open source software and then package it up into a database and then check it myself? Sure. But it'd be much easier if I you know, just buy the stick service and then query it myself.
Well, which is why that those businesses are doing well, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, like that, but they are not, you know, like, and I'm not going to pick on them, but like, you know, any commercial tool or even open source tool is never going to give you 100%, right? No. And so you need a little bit of customization no matter what you do, no matter where you are. And I think that's, it also gives, you know, team members an opportunity to shine as well and do some really interesting stuff and solving, you know, what can be boring problems in novel ways. And so, you know, we use Signal Sciences. That's, this is the third company that I brought them in for. I think, you know, the product is great. The dev teams really love it. The initial teams that we're working with right now just really love the visibility. They love just seeing the alerts that pop up that someone's scanning them or someone's attempting a type of attack and it's got the attack tooling right there in Slack. And, you know, they've just been really open to that and looking forward to like utilizing some of their latest features as far as like the bot detection goes and stuff like that to, you know, hopefully detect and help mitigate, work with our fraud folks and how to, you know, catch the bad guys and prevent them from going too far. So
yeah, it's a combination between build and, you know, build and buy, but what are you buying? I mean, I guess that's why it's interesting. You're working in a critical environment, right? So, you know, for you to be, using a commercial off the shelf product, I'm guessing that's, you know, that means it's a pretty good one, right? So, okay, we've got Signal Sciences. Like what about on that, you know, composition analysis side, which tool did you go with there?
Yeah. So the problem for us or one of our main challenges, I should say, is that we're a Scala shop. And so tools are pretty scarce, whether they're commercial or open source, that are, you know, written for Scala. Security engineers are also you know, a bit rare with the Scala experience. So if you know anyone, let me know. But we're trying out SemGrep from R2C, working closely with them for they don't quite have Scala support yet, but there are certain other portions of our code base that they use like Python or Go or whatever. So we're working with them. And that's what we've targeted so far. We use a lot of custom stuff. We've got a lot of...
Well, you have to, because you're using a weird language.
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, it's again, the whole build versus buy kind of gets thrown out the window because I don't really have too much choice in what to buy.
But I mean, I guess that's why, you know, you can speak to the Signal Sciences thing is because web attacks are kind of generic, right? Like they are. Right. It doesn't really matter which platform, you know, which tech stack you're using. I mean, SQLi is SQLi.
Yep, exactly. And it's easy to use. It integrates with a bunch of things, you know, like it's just kind of a set it and forget it type of thing. And so that's great. But one of the things that we're focusing on for the next quarter is automating, right? Just we want to automate ourselves out of a job. You know, we're going to look at different layers or different levels of the SDLC, right? Whether that's you know, integrations, maybe some custom plugins that we can write for developer IDEs, pre-commit hooks within GitHub, GitHub Actions, you know, various regex-based sorts of things.
So, like, by the sounds of things, it sounds like, you know, yours is an engineering-heavy role, right? Like, a lot of building.
Yes, yeah. You know, like I said, the team is composed of builders and breakers, but I think where we are as a company and as a security team, we are more focused on, you know, building security into the SDLC and into like the, you know, the very fabric of developing software at Gemini. And so,
and you're hiring too, right? Like this is one of the things you wanted to say while you were here.
Believe it or not. Yes, we are hiring builders and breakers. You know, you don't necessarily need to have Scala experience, although that's, that will obviously help, but, also smart contract review, you know, anything you have experience in the crypto industry, definitely looking for.
You can pay Dan Guido a gajillion dollars a day to do that.
Yeah.
Or you can hire someone.
I've had several phone calls with Dan and known Dan for a while as well. So, all good.
All right. Well, Doug DePerry, thank you so much for joining us on the show to talk through, you know, what it's like for you. Working over there at Gemini and dealing with that sort of critical environment. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
That was Doug DePerry there with a chat about being the head of product security at Gemini. Big thanks to him for that, and huge thanks to Signal Sciences for sponsoring this week's show. And look, I know a number of Signal Sciences users, so if you're looking for something that's easy to deploy to give your web apps a reasonable level of protection, it's probably a product you want to be familiar with. That's it for today. I will be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.